this is Jonathan Sanger. I'm the author of Making the Elephant Man, a producer's memoir, and I was the producer of the Elephant Man movie, starring John Hurt and Anthony Hopkins and directed by David Lynch back in 1980. I've produced many, many movies since then, and currently I have a movie coming out in October called Marshall with Chadwick Boseman, Josh Gad, and Kate Hudson. I am going to be talking to Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By at UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, my friends. This is your old pal, Rabbi Saul Solomon, founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I am delighted to be talking to a movie person. A lot of times on this program, I talk to music people and theater people, but now I have an Oscar-winning producer. His name is Jonathan Sanger, and he's worked on such films as Harry and Tonto and Vanilla Sky and Flight of the Navigator. He even produced a Broadway musical called Baby It's You, which we're going to talk about. But most of all, we're going to talk about the movie The Elephant Man, which this man produced back in 1980. So please, will you welcome the elephant in the room, Jonathan Sanger? Shalom.
Shalom. How are you, Rabbi Solomon?
I'm doing better than American the Elephant Man. I'm feeling a little better than he did.
I understand.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say one thing, Rabbi. I am from Brooklyn, New York, and my rabbi was Avram Heller at the Flappish Jewish Center. So everything dates back to New York. That's where it all started. But I've been in the movie business for most of my adult life and living in Los Angeles and in New York, back and forth. And I did The Elephant Man in 1980, and it was a tremendous experience, something I could never have imagined it would have become in the way it was, because it was the first movie I ever produced.
Even before we get to the movie, though, you can't drop in a bomb like saying you were from Brooklyn and Flatbush without my going there. First of all, I'm going to drop a name on you, the alma mater of the host of this radio program, Dave Lefkowitz, who went to a place called Bialik School. Does that ring any bells?
Well, I went to public school. I would have gone to Erasmus, actually, because that was the neighborhood I lived in, but I wound up going to Poly Prep in Diker Heights in Brooklyn.
But you know Avenue C, Avenue M? Any memories?
Yeah, I do. I remember Avenue M. I lived on Argyle Road between Cortelyou and Beverly. It was right in the middle of that section of Brooklyn, which has now become kind of a renaissance there. But I lived on 200 East 8th Street. That was the first place I lived. But it was a relatively eclectic neighborhood even then, and it went through a lot of changes over the years. But I was there through college until I ultimately got into the movie business.
Take us through being just a nice, almost yeshiva, I mean, we're public school, but we'll forgive you,
yeah,
almost a yeshiva bracha, to being a movie producer.
It was an interesting thing because I started out, I was always interested in performing. That was my original thing. I was in plays in high school and public school.
All right, stop. What shows were you in high school?
Well, I was in high school, we used to do a musical every other year. I was in both the Mikado and the Pirates of Penzance, because we did Gilbert and Sullivan. I was also in the play, The Caine Mutiny.
Ooh.
And a few other, I'm trying to think of some of the other plays I was in. I was in Androcles and the Lion. I was in a lot of plays in high school.
What was your biggest role? Did you ever star?
Yes, I starred in most of them. I had starring roles. I was in The King and I played the King. I played Frederick, the Pirate's Apprentice, in Pirates of Penzance, which was a major role. But as I got older, you know, when I got to be a senior, I tended to wind up in leading roles. And I always loved theater, and I always loved music.
You didn't get the bug to become or try to become an actor after high school or during college?
Yes, in college. In college, I was a member of the Pennsylvania Players at the University of Pennsylvania, and I was actually the chairman of the board of the Pennsylvania Players when I was a senior. And that was a drama group. So I was involved in drama and directing and producing and acting, and it was only after I went into graduate school in film and television that I decided I really wanted to get involved in movies, because it was a medium where I could actually, you know, there would be a record. It wouldn't just be the people who saw it one time and said, oh, you were great in that play, but they could actually look at it again. It was a recording medium, and I kind of liked that. And from that point on, I got involved in film and television.
Did you make short movies in grad school?
I did. I made a movie called Channel Cat in the Middle Distance. It was a short film about Gene Shepard, who was a major radio personality in New York at the time.
Of course, he's the guy who the Christmas Story is based on his recollections. Yeah.
Exactly right. That was my
graduate. Well, by the way, I'm sorry. I apologize for saying the word Christmas. It's not a word I use very much.
I understand.
Continue, yes.
For me, it was a Hanukkah story, but I understand what you're saying.
Again, the Gene Shepard piece that you did in grad school. So did that lead to further things?
Well, it did. It did. What it led to was I wound up going into the Peace Corps, and I was in the Peace Corps in a special program in television, educational television in South America. And I was there for 2 years in the late 60s, early 70s, and when I came back, I wanted to get involved in the film business, and I became an assistant director in motion pictures in New York City, and that was at probably 1970.
Now, how did you get even that gig?
Well, that gig came from, I applied to the Directors Guild. They had a training program, and they had about 1,000 people apply, but they only accepted 5. And I was one of the people who was accepted. And I was a little older than some because many of them were just out of college. I'd already been to graduate school and spent a little time out of the country. So I had a little bit of a leg up on some of the other applicants, I think.
And I assume your years literally doing film and TV in the Peace Corps helped. Yeah.
I think it helped a lot. And so I wound up getting into the Directors Guild. I was picked and selected. And they would assign you to movies that were being made in New York. You'd get to work at a really subsistence wage. I was making $150 a week to work as a production assistant on motion pictures in New York. And at that time, I worked on, a bunch of movies. I worked on a movie called Across 110th Street. I worked on a number of other films that were made in New York during that period of time, which the early 70s, that was.
Now, let me ask you, Jonathan Sanger, when you say you worked on these movies, what was a day like working on a movie in the 1970s, one of these films, in your capacity?
Well, what I did as an assistant director or even as a production assistant, which was pretty much the same work, it's just you had a little less authority, I would make sure that all the actors for any given day were called at the time that they needed to be there. I had a call sheet which had all their information on it, told me where to find them, how to reach them, how to make sure that they got all the information that they needed and the location where we were filming. I was involved in anything that was needed to be done, even if it was from the simplest thing like getting coffee for an actor or a director or running errands, to do anything that was required on the movie set in any given day, I did. And in fact, it was a difficult time in some ways because my parents and other relatives would ask me, well, you're working in the movie business, what do you do? And I, for example, I was working on a movie with Anthony Quinn. Huh. And my father said to me, what is Anthony Quinn like? And I said, black, no sugar. I said, that's what I know about him. No, takes his coffee black, and he likes Chinese greens for lunch. And that was my responsibility. So in those days, that's how it started. But I did get to observe, and I got to see how movies were made, and I got to see the real inside story about how the process went, and that was fascinating to me. And these were usually movies that took about anywhere from 30 to 40 days of filming to get made. And I would get to work those 40 days and get very close to the actors and director and other high mucky mucks who were working on the movie. And that was my first job. And those jobs escalated as I moved up the food chain. I got a little bit more responsibility until I became an assistant director myself, in which case I would schedule the movie, I would help budget the movie, I would do all of those things, and I'd be involved in the rehearsal period, all of those other things, with the director.
Rolling back a little bit, just for fun.
Sure.
Do you recall any great blow-ups, like diva moments for directors or actors that you worked with back in the day on those feature films?
Sure I do. There were always...
Ooh, do tell.
I mean, the truth is not all actors tended to be divas, but some did. I worked on a movie with Faye Dunaway, and Faye Dunaway and her makeup artist used to get into, and the makeup artist was someone that Faye had on the movie Network, in fact. And I was an assistant director on that movie, and Faye was the star. She would get into shouting matches with her makeup artist, and I was responsible to try to get her out on the set. The funny thing was, her makeup artist was a beautiful woman. Most people who wandered around the set thought that she was the star. I mean, you know, and she was, and she and Faye used to get into heated arguments about what it was going to take and how Faye was going to look on that given day. So that there were always these crazy fights that I'd have to witness and try to calm everybody down and figure out a way to get work done. But these were not unusual. It happened on other movies, different things. I worked with Marlo Thomas on a movie called Thieves, and Marlo was the lead actress in it. In fact, you might remember Irwin Corey.
He just died a couple of weeks ago.
He played her father on the movie, and in that particular event, we had a director on the movie named John Berry. John had been a blacklisted director during the famous blacklist period and went to work in France, and he had just come back to the States. He had done a movie called Claudine with Diane Carroll, and then right after that, he was doing this movie, Thieves. He was very strong-willed, and we filmed for 4 weeks, and he and Marlo did not get along. She didn't like the way she was being photographed. She didn't like the way the cameraman was working with her. And she had a lot of power. And her boyfriend was Herb Gardner, who wrote the screenplay. Herb was a famous writer, theater writer.
Right.
And Herb had written, he wrote a movie called 1,000 Clowns, which is quite well known. Herb had done a lot of plays. At a certain point, after 4 weeks, the studio decided to fire the director because they sided with Marlo, and they decided to bring in another director. In fact, they made the writer, Herb Gardner, the director. And that was a pretty unusual circumstance, I have to say, having to live through that and see the crew change. New people came in. We didn't lose a day. And Herb Gardner had never directed before, so he needed a little bit of help. And one of his close friends was, great director who had done tons of theater. In any event, he brought in help during lunch. He would kind of take lessons in directing, but he managed to finish the film, and it was really an unusual circumstance. Not funny, actually, but complicated and difficult.
Now, did any director ever take out their stuff on you because you were a peon bringing coffee? Did you ever get chewed out or fired?
I did. In fact, on that very same movie, I got chewed out by the director because...
The original director, Berry, not
Gardner. John Berry, the first director. Because we were filming up at a school right on the east side of Central Park. We had a bunch of kids who were waiting across the street, and he was rushing to get them into the school and wanted me to get them to move across the street. And I held them back because I was concerned about traffic and safety and other things. And he, for some reason, was not. So he yelled at me because I spoke right back to him. I said, look, you may be the director, but I'm not going to put anybody in harm's way just because you tell me to. I mean, right now, I'm going to wait until the light changes, and that's when they're going to cross the street. It was not a pleasant experience because he really excoriated me in front of everybody, but I took it. You know, I figured, all right. I didn't get fired, actually, but I just got yelled at.
And he got fired, so you got your revenge in a way.
I did.
Now, we're talking with Jonathan Sanger, producer, theater, and film. Let's now get to going from helping other people on their films towards producing your very own movie, which was a big one, The Elephant Man.
Well, this was a really interesting story because I had been in a production manager, which is another step up the ladder, really, and a production manager is kind of like a technical producer in a way. I mean, you basically run things, but you do it under the tutelage and discretion of the producer. I tell it in the book, but what had happened was I had a babysitter and two young boys, and my babysitter had once asked me if I'd read a script that her boyfriend had written. And, I mean, in Hollywood, everybody has a script, everybody. I mean, you can't go into a supermarket without running into somebody who wants to hand you a script if they think you're in the film business, or they want to hand you what they call a headshot, which is a photograph of themselves because they want to be actors. Either they want to be a writer or an actor. Those are the two things you see all the time. In any event, my babysitter had a boyfriend who she said, wanted to be a writer, and he'd written the script with his friend, and would I read it? And I said, oh, sure I will, you know, and at the time, I knew that even if I read it, I didn't have any power to get it made. But I put it aside, and I went on to do other things. And one day, I came back into my house. The babysitter was no longer working for me, and I realized that I had not read the script that I told her I would read. And so I sat down, and I started to read it. Well, the script was The Elephant Man. This was the story. And and I was fascinated by it. I was kind of amazed that it was written by these two unknown writers who probably hadn't written any other certainly hadn't written any other screenplays before. I immediately got her number from my wife and called her up and said, look, I just read the script. I apologize. It took me so long, but it's fantastic. I'd love to meet with the writers. And she hooked me up with her boyfriend and his writing partner. I invited them over to my house, and I said, look, I'm trying to produce movies. That's what I really want to do right now. And I just read your script, and I love it. And I would like to make this the first movie I make. What do you want? I mean, what do you want to do? And they said, well, we just want to be the writers. You know, I mean, that's it. We're just concerned that, you know, I mean, we've heard the Hollywood stories that people take scripts from people who've written them and then bring in their own people and throw the original people off. And I said, well, I'm not going to do that. I said, there's no, you know, I mean, I like this script. I'm not going to, not looking to fire you or change you. I think you guys did a great job. So let's go from there. And I offered to pay them what I thought was a fair amount of money as an option, meaning that I had the exclusive right to try to get it made. If it did get made, they would get paid a purchase price, which I wouldn't have to pay, but would be paid by whatever company ultimately funded the movie. And they agreed, and that was it, and that was the beginning of it. It just so happened that I was working during that period as an assistant director for Mel Brooks, and I knew Mel, and I had worked with Mel on a movie called High Anxiety. I was his first assistant director. Right after that, we became friends, and he said to me, look, I'd like you to work with my wife. She's going to be directing her first movie. It's called Fatso with Dom DeLuise, and I'd like you to help produce it, if you would, because I know you know how to make movies. I see how you work. You work with me. So while I was doing that movie, that's when the script came to me. One day, I had taken it to the office where I gave it to Mel's secretary, who was a friend of mine, and I said, look, would you read this? Tell me if you think it's as good as I do. And I gave it to her. In the meantime, I was called to go to New York with Anne for a couple of days to do some location scouting, and I had left the script with the secretary. It turns out that Mel, who had come into the office while I was gone, was talking to the secretary, and he saw the script, and it was called The Elephant. He says, what's this? She says, oh, it's a script that Jonathan gave me. He optioned it. It's trying to get it made. And Mel, who is a notorious insomniac, always looking for something to read, and a very good reader. I mean, he's loved to read Russian tragedies. I mean, he was nothing that you might expect from a guy with his comic abilities. Picked up the script, went home and read it, totally unbeknownst to me. I get a call the next day. I'm in New York with Mel's wife, Anne, and he calls me up and he says, look, I just read this script. What is this? Who owns this? What's the story? So I said, well, it's a script that I read and I liked and I optioned, and I'm trying to see if I can get it made. He says, well, wait a minute. When you come back to L.A., you got to meet with me. I want to talk to you. And that was it. So I'm back in L.A. the next 2 days later, probably, and he calls me into his office and he says, look, I'm starting a company to make movies other than my own comedies, and I love this story, and I will help you raise the money for this if you want to do it through my company and with me. Well, this was like unbelievable. I had just started to take it around to studios. I didn't even have any clout. I didn't know anybody really at the right levels to be able to get a movie made, and here was Mel Brooks saying to me he was going to help me get it made. I mean, I couldn't imagine a more positive outcome. I couldn't believe it, really. He said, no, we're going to meet this week with my lawyer. Let's sit down. Let's talk about it. Let's figure out a way to get this thing done. It's exactly what happened. I went in completely unarmed, alone, no lawyers, no nothing. I didn't have a lawyer. You know, I just went in and I sat down with him and his lawyer. And he said, look, we want to do this movie. We trust you. We believe you can produce it. We will help you arrange the financing. Here's what we'll do. And it was, basically explaining what I would get paid, what kind of profit split there would be, all of the things like that, which were new to me, but fascinating. And he said, look, why don't you get your people together? I'll get my people and they'll meet. You know, I said, great, we'll do that. You know, and then I left and then I realized I didn't have any people. You know, and so I had to find somebody. So I called a lawyer that I knew at my son's school, who I knew was in the entertainment business, and I said, look, I have this potential deal, and I don't have anybody to represent me. Could you perhaps consider doing that? Of course, I'll pay you. And he agreed. And that was the beginning. He and Mel's lawyer sat down and worked out a contract. But the idea was for me to produce it. We had no director at the time. It was just me and the script and the writers.
Well, let me ask you a quick question, Jonathan Sanger, about this process, because you're also a theater guy. Mel Brooks is a theater guy.
Sure.
This was happening in, like, 1979. Were there any issues with another writer, Bernard Pomerantz, who wrote a play on Broadway called The Elephant Man?
Yes, yes. In fact, you're exactly right. The interesting thing about this was this all predated the play being even off Broadway. There was no Elephant Man play when the events that I'm talking about happened with Mel. It was back in probably late summer, early, something like that, of 1979, and the play didn't show up until, I think, September, October, whatever it was. All of a sudden, the play opened off-Broadway, got tremendous reviews. I get a call from Mel's office saying, hey, did you hear about this? This is from the secretary, my friend Randy Auerbach, and she calls me up and she says, I just see that a play called The Elephant Man just opened off-Broadway. And my heart sunk, and I said, oh, my God, no, there's no chance. And I was really, really down because I hadn't seen the play, but I was just upset because my big chance was to make this movie, and now someone else had a play out of the same name. Presumably, it was the same story. I go into the office to meet with Mel to see what he thought about it, and he was very philosophic about it. He said, look, these things happen. He said, but it's not going to stop us. We're going ahead. We're making this movie. I just would like to make sure. I don't want the writers to go see it because I don't want to have any issues with the play. We are going to go ahead on our track and let them do what they do. And the play obviously moved on from off-Broadway to Broadway. It continued to move along. In the meantime, we continued on our track to develop the movie and got David Lynch and started to make it.
Wasn't Dustin Hoffman at one point kind of interested?
Oh, yes. In fact, when the lawyer for Mel was also the lawyer for Dustin Hoffman, and he told us one day when we were starting the process of casting, he said, look, Dustin might be interested in doing the movie. It was the great news and the not-so-great news. The great news was we had a major actor who was interested in doing it, and from my standpoint, the not-so-great news was I didn't think he was right for it. I didn't think he was right for it for a very specific reason. My feeling was that if you're going to make somebody the Elephant Man and he has to be deformed and he has to look in a certain way, which we all felt it had to be, we weren't making a fantasy, we were trying to make something that was as close to the reality of the situation as possible, that if you had an actor as world famous as Dustin Hoffman, you'd always be looking to see where Dustin Hoffman ended and the makeup began, and you'd be much more concerned about all of those issues. Whereas if you had an actor who people didn't generally know, who was just a great actor, that would be a better way to go. On the other hand, I must say that was just my consideration and was not really in tune with the economics of the business, where if you could get an actor like Dustin Hoffman, boy, you should. Generally, that's the way Hollywood thinks. You can get somebody who's a big name and who means a lot, and audiences know, you're going to get a lot more people wanting to come see your movie. But I was very convincing, and Mel basically agreed and said, no, you're right. We actually shouldn't use Dustin Hoffman for all of the very same reasons that I had just mentioned. That was that. And we were looking for an actor of great talent, but not of the kind of renown that Dustin Hoffman already had at that point.
We're talking, by the way, with Jonathan Sanger, the producer of the 1980 film The Elephant Man. When did you realize that the finished product was a good movie and one that people would be interested in? Because you had the director's only previous credit was Eraserhead, which was a cult film. So when did you realize, aha, this may go further than just a little small art film?
I'll tell you, it wasn't until the result of the first major screening we had in Hollywood, because I really, really didn't know. In fact, David and I used to meet once a week. David Lynch and I used to meet once a week in London, and we'd have dinner together, and we would talk about our dreams. And our dreams were just to have the movie open in one theater. I mean, we just said, oh, it'd be great. We can go to a theater and see our movie and have our friends come see it. I mean, we really didn't think beyond what might happen to us. We didn't realize that the movie actually would take a life of its own beyond us. It wasn't until the early screenings in Los Angeles where there was a buzz about it, and people started responding to it. And Paramount, which had the rights to distribute it, although they hadn't put up any money, they had bought the distribution rights, began to have it screened for critics, what they call long lead critics, you know, magazine critics and people like that. The reason they're called long lead is because they need a lot of time, because magazines are planned months in advance. So they saw the movie before anybody else. They saw it before any newspapers or anybody else. And Paramount started getting calls from these writers saying, hey, we loved the movie, we thought it was fantastic. And they would get initial reviews to hold on to until the magazines were released. It just began to, a groundswell started to happen. We started to say, wait a minute, there's something really special here. This is more than just another story. This seems to be catching on. There's some real interest here. And finally, we got a call from Paramount Pictures, which was releasing the movie. And they said, look, we have two movies that we're releasing around the same time. One is The Elephant Man, which we want to release in a, what we call a platform release. We'll put it in about 250 theaters, and then we'll build up to more as the movie demands. And another movie is called Ordinary People, Robert Redford made. Now, the difference is Paramount funded Robert Redford's movie. He wasn't the star of it. He was the director of it. And they had a big obligation to him. To us, we were just an acquisition. But we did find that their marketing people really loved our movie, and they were very, very serious about it. And when we found that it was something a little bit more special than even we thought, was when they had announced the date for the movie to be released. The date for Ordinary People was going to be 2 weeks later. And I then got a call from one of the executives at Paramount, and he said, look, Robert Redford, we showed him a screening of the movie because he wanted to see it. He had heard people talking about it. He's demanded that we change the release date and have his movie released first and your movie released second. And I'm sorry we have to tell you, but he's a very important client of ours. It won't hurt your movie, but we're going to change the dates and put his movie first. Well, that was the first indication in my mind that we really had something very special, because all of the talk at that point was about Academy Awards, nominations, things like that. When the movie was released, we were nominated for 8 Academy Awards, which completely blew me away. I had no idea that anything like that would happen. And in fact, Ordinary People, which won the Academy Award for Best Picture that year, was our biggest competition. I must say, I could not have imagined a scenario like that when I started, not in my wildest dreams.
Now, let's remind folks that Jonathan Sanger has put all these dreams that he's been talking about into the book Making the Elephant Man, a producer's memoir, which is available from McFarlane and Company Books. But, you know, your story does not stop in 1980. I mean, it's been 30-something years.
Thankfully, no. It's continued on. I've made lots of movies since then.
including the film with Jessica Lange Francis. That was your next big project. Now, did you make that with Brooks Films as well, or did you move?
I did. In fact, I made several movies with Brooks Films, because Mel and I, and up until 2005, when I produced the musical version of The Producers with Mel. So we had stayed very close. We're still close. But we had stayed close all those years, and any time I had a project that I thought he might be interested in, I would bring it to him, and if he wanted to do it, we did it together. So it was quite a terrific beginning for me, and he was really my mentor. I mean, there's no question. I still look to him for advice on things like reading Russian novelists and comedy and even serious matters. But he's a wonderful guy.
But what I'm kind of wondering about is, you had that big critical and something of a commercial hit with Elephant Man.
Yes.
A big studio project like Francis. And as you say, you've done many, many movies since then. But it feels like you didn't stay in that big budget Hollywood thing once you were there to do that.
Well, the main reason, yes, that's true. I mean, I did do big movies. I did Vanilla Sky with Tom Cruise. I did other things like that. But I have, you know, in the last, I would say, 15 years or more, I kind of got a little upset with the studio process, because I found that I had very little, as much power as you have. I mean, the studios tended to have a lot more, and I just wasn't getting the kind of projects made that I wanted to. And I had enjoyed the career that I'd had before, but I decided that working independently would be more interesting and more satisfying, even if it meant that the budgets would be smaller. And that is basically what I've been doing ever since. I've been doing independent movies that have been, I mean, the movie Marshall, which is coming out in October, is being released by the company called Open Road. And Open Road was the same company that released Spotlight a few years ago that was an Academy Award winner. So it's a great movie about an early time in the career of Thurgood Marshall, the great Supreme Court Justice. But this was when he was just a young lawyer in the 40s.
At that point, he was Thur not so good Marshall.
When he was just the beginning of his career, and he had a particular case in Connecticut, a civil rights case that he was to fight, and that's what this story is about. And that one's coming out this September. But it's the kind of movie that major studios aren't making anymore. The main reason why I'm working independently is because studios tend to be making sequels, comic books, big action films, none of which I'm disparaging. I mean, they're movies I go to see, but they're not the kind of movies that I personally want to make. I like making movies about real stories, real people, if I can, and great characters, and those are the kinds of things that tend to be made now by independent filmmakers. And in fact, Elephant Man, even though it was made by a major studio, if that movie was to be made today, it would be made independently. It wouldn't be made by a studio. So, it's just that's the trend, and certainly the trend in my own career.
Now, one thing I noticed when you go on your IMDb page is you've done a lot of short films. And I have to wonder, where's the percentage in that? I mean, you have to raise a bit of money to make those, but how do you even, they go into festivals, maybe they go on HBO.
Rabbi, there is no percentage in it. I mean, there really is no way to make money doing short films. I did it initially as a program that I created with a partner to help new directors get started, and we were funded initially by Columbia Pictures and then by Showtime for a number of years, but they were definitely not profit centers. They weren't anything that could be made that you could consider to make money. It was just an opportunity for not a lot of money to be able to show off the talents of the individuals who worked on them and hopefully get them to the place where they could make major movies. I did that for a while until obviously I had. I still needed to work and I still needed to make a living, and there wasn't much of a living in that, although it was very satisfying because we were nominated for my company and I were nominated for almost 11 Academy Awards for short films and won three. So
you had a movie called Ray's Male Heterosexual Dance Hall.
That's right. One of the first shorts we made, and it was a comedy. And it was about where you go to get ahead in life. You know, how do you meet the right people? And that's, you go to Ray's Male Heterosexual Dance Hall, and that was what the short was about. But it won Academy Award, and was a tremendously exciting moment.
Now, as much as I love movies, I'm a bit more of a theater and Broadway person, and it's nice to know that you have had a hand in a couple of Broadway shows as well. One of them,
hoping to have my hand in a few more. It's something that I love. I've always loved theater from the beginning. I mean, I got into movies sideways initially, but theater is live performance is something that I'm thrilled about. And I got an opportunity to be involved with an old friend of mine who I went to high school with, who was a major music producer named Richard Perry. Richard, who produced Barbara Streisand and Carly Simon and tons and tons of other performers over the years. And we got together with a director and put together a show called Baby, It's You, which was about the rise of the Shirelles, which were one of the early girl groups in New Jersey in the 50s. And the woman who was the producer of she was the first woman record producer named Florence Greenberg. And Florence, basically, in addition to the Shirelles, she also produced Dionne Warwick, Burt Bacharach, many, many, many other artists. And the play was about that and using that music, and it was quite fun. I enjoyed it a lot, and we did it here in L.A. in a small theater, and then ultimately it was picked up by Warner Brothers, the theatrical unit of Warner Brothers, and they put up the money to put it on Broadway, and it ran for about 10 months.
Because I remember a lot of people that I know went to see it and enjoyed it. It just it didn't quite become a hit. The critics
didn't. No, it wasn't. It wasn't a big hit, but it was actually, I think of it as more of a touring play, and I'm surprised, though, that there, you know, I haven't had the time nor the ability to get moving on it as a touring play. But I don't think, I mean, New York critics are very tough, and you really gotta wow them in many, many ways. And I think, you know, they just saw it as another jukebox musical, which to a certain extent it is, because there's songs in it are songs that are familiar to baby boomers and, even pre-baby boomers, those of us who were born at the end of World War II. But, I mean, the music was kind of like Jersey Boys, but not certainly of the critical acclaim that Jersey Boys got.
Didn't you also have some involvement?
I mean, a fun play nevertheless, and I loved going to see it because I love to watch the audience and see how different audiences reacted to it. But it was a very positive experience, I must say.
But didn't you also have involvement in Million Dollar Quartet?
I did.
Which has been done everywhere. Now,
Million Dollar Quartet is still playing everywhere. So, I mean, there is a perfect example of a play that played on Broadway, had a nice run, but its real success was on the road. It's played in every small town everywhere. I mean, and it just keeps going. You know, it had a really strong reaction. Once again, it was in a way, certainly it is a jukebox musical, but the story was a story that somehow caught people's attention. Now, I'm interested in doing other plays that are not necessarily, that have real scores and, that aren't just from,
pop hits and then...
Pop hits, right. But theater is, it's a very different discipline. Tends to take a lot more. Not every play is right for Broadway. Even ones that can be very successful may not be right for Broadway. So you really have to be, and I was just learning it. I mean, it's a new avenue for me, but I enjoy it. I love going to theater, and when I'm in New York, I always try to see everything I can. So everything that's, everything that I've heard is good. So I'll continue trying to get involved in plays. That's certainly something that's going to happen. Not just musicals either. I mean, I have some, I've been doing readings of some straight plays that I think are very good that might get done. So we'll see.
Ooh. Can't wait to see more work coming from Jonathan Sanger. Now you're 73 years old, right?
That's right.
So no slowing down for a long while?
Slowing down. I'm a very young 73, at least to me. I feel I got a lot of time, and I'm doing exactly what I want to do, which is really the fun part. And I think there may be some other books that I want to write because there have been experiences that I've had that I think deserve telling. But this particular story, Making the Elephant, was a very special one to me because it was the first, and it was an important movie.
Well, you always remember your first.
It kind of hit the zeitgeist in a way that I could never have imagined when I started.
Now, last couple of quick questions.
Sure.
For Jonathan Sanger. Just kind of fun ones and stuff I want to hear a little bit more about. You have to have some kind of story about working on a comedy called Movie Movie that was directed by Stanley Donen and starred George C. Scott. A personality like that, please tell me there's some kind of story.
Oh, there's a million stories. Oh. That was a great, again, another terrific experience. Stanley Donen was a hero of mine for his musicals that he had done in the 50s. And when I had the opportunity to work with him, I couldn't believe it. I mean, I was both the production manager and the first assistant director on the movie. And Stanley had just come back from almost, 10 years of exile in England, where when I say exile, I mean, it was very much his own choice. But he had made movies in the States, and then he kind of moved to London married an English woman in the peerage, and wound up making a few movies over there. He made a movie called Charade. He made a movie called Arabesque. He had done a bunch of movies, and he had just come back to the States and had this opportunity to make a movie. Movie was really an homage to the movies of the 40s. One of the movies was to be a fight movie, like a Jimmy Cagney fight movie, and the other one was to be like a Busby Berkeley musical. And we did the two over the period that you would normally do one movie, and George C. Scott was in both of them. He was the lead. The interesting thing was, the idea of it was that we'd have the same people in both movies in different roles. We'd use the same props in both movies. One was in color, one was in black and white. We'd use the same sets, we just redress them, because they used to do that in Hollywood. So we did all of the things, and Stanley had a tremendous knowledge of the history of Hollywood, so it was a great experience. But as powerful as Stanley was, George C. Scott was really the reason the movies got made. At the time, he was the star. We had cast a woman to play the role of the female lead in one of the two movies, and George basically said, without making a demand, he said, look, I don't think I want to, I've decided not to do the movie. And we said, what? What's going on? Why don't you want to do the movie? He said, I don't know. And what we found out was we hadn't cast his wife, Trish Van Devere, in any role, and there was a role in the movie that she wanted. It was never expressed to us as a requirement. It wasn't even a request. But once we decided to cast Trish in the movie, George wound up being happy to be in it. So we had that issue covered, and that was one of the things that happened. But we had crazy things happen because Art Carney was in the movie. And at the time, Art was, I mean, a wonderful, wonderful actor, incredible guy, but a pretty heavy drinker.
Not that George C. Scott was a teetotaler either.
No, neither of them were. And one day, while we were waiting on the set for George, George had invited Art into his trailer, and we kept knocking on the door. We never got any answer, never got any answer. We're waiting and waiting and waiting on the set. Nobody comes out. Finally, I knock on the door, and I think, please, please. And the door opens, and George and Art come stumbling out of the trailer. They're both completely on the other side, 12 sheets of the wind. I mean, really gone. They said, look, we're going out. I mean, I got them a car, and the two of them left the set, and we had to figure out what to do that day because neither of them were in any shape to film. So, I mean, we had crazy things happen all the time on movies. You try to keep them from becoming public at the time, and you try to keep them from stopping you in your tracks from making the movie. But movie was a fun experience. We had some terrific actors, many from old Hollywood. Red Buttons was in it. Just a lot of really, really interesting characters.
Well, you, Jonathan Sanger, are a very interesting character indeed, and we are delighted and have been delighted to have you in the neighborhood talking about all your movies, including, of course, The Elephant Man and your book, Making the Elephant Man, a producer's memoir from McFarland and Company. Last question for you.
Mm-hmm.
What's your favorite movie of all time?
Wow, that's a tough one. I mean, I am a major lover of Citizen Kane. I've always thought that was one of the greatest movies I've ever seen. But I'm also a tremendous, tremendous lover of the original Godfather movies, the first two. Really, really convinced me that I wanted to be in this business more than anything else. So I would have to really be looking at those movies as some of my very favorites.
Well, Jonathan Sanger, I hope you go on to make many more movies and do that theater thing.
Absolutely.
And thank you so much for being with us in the neighborhood. Shalom to you.
Thank you. Shalom.